These were wonderful stories, and when you equate with a character in the story, you feel for the story. For example, Jenny. I wanted to grab Jenny and go like that with either side of my hand. I felt almost that way with Hawk. Of course, I...
He just struck back.
Yeah. The battles between Rhonda and Moore were familiar to me because I've seen that happen among my own friends and associates. The story that struck me was the title story. At first, I didn't know what was going on. I was confused by it at first, but by the time I got to the end, it all made sense what you were trying to do. That was a very unusual approach, creating these suicides at various stages of, or deaths. I'm not sure the first one was a suicide, was it? When Delia was two, I believe. Was her father a suicide, or was it a... wasn't quite sure there.
Well...
It was in the basement with blood.
Yes. What happened, what I was hoping to convey, was what it was like to survive a devastating event in one's life, and what it does to one's memories, happy memories also. And so I worked from the... It took me years. It wasn't something I just... say, well, we'll try it this way. This was the last thing I could think to do to convey all of that at once. And, of course, you can't convey it at once. It came out in a linear fashion, and there were two ways I could have done it, was beginning at 18 and moving back to 2, or as I chose to do it, which was reveal her whole life slowly as she grew up, within one day, really, from daybreak till midnight. And none of these things is in real time, of course, but what I was hoping to convey was the way that memory is acted upon by an event, a terrible event, and it's rearranged, memory is rearranged. I don't know enough about the physiology of the brain to say something like that happens when we are not aware of it, but once we have access to our memories and we are thinking, here's a safe place where we have not been hurt because this was before the event, something will happen and we will realize that it may have been before the event, but it's tarnished now as we've taken it out into the light of our now knowledge. It's ruined also. And that was what I was rather hoping to convey, although I didn't care how it was conveyed, if it was conveyed in feeling, if you felt that, or if you... There are some people who have written me and told me that, who have been through a similar circumstance, and they say, this is exactly the way you feel, is that it happened on every day of your life. And my feeling in real time of the story was that it happened on her 18th, in her 18th year. But the fact that it ruined every day of her life, and that she had lived in dread from the beginning of her life of something terrible happening which would destroy her family. She didn't know what that event would be, but she lived with that anxiety. She was an anxious child. And so this was sort of how I was working, these two ideas that I was trying to satisfy while I was simply telling the story. And that, I think that in years to come I will figure out, it will be a moment when I understand how I could have made all of this in one sentence, 10 words, you know, aha, and that's it. But I don't know that now, and I've told people who think they do know not to tell me how I could have done it. But I did the best I could at the moment, and so what I conveyed was, in a sense, a confusion that will confuse a reader and if they don't stick to the last page. And if they do come to the last page and then go back and read again, they'll begin to see, I hope, a kind of emotional coherence, although the story itself does seem to recur, the suicide seems to recur. But what I'm saying is it marks every day of your past as well as your future as you are a survivor.
It's quite a challenging story, and I was confused by it, and I did go back, and I did resolve that confusion. And so I marveled at what you were able to do with that story. You also compact a lot of information in a small amount of, in a small number of words. For example, the story of Rhonda and Moore. I mean, you covered an awful lot of ground, a lot of years there, didn't you, in a small amount of time.
I enjoyed thinking up how to do that story. And one of the things I wished to do was to have it all It's something I enjoy working with is, as you say, compressing time or compacting events and then having access to them in small sidelights that all of a sudden illuminate backward and you think, oh, that's what happened to that. And it might be pages and pages later and it will seem irrelevant at the moment, but it illuminates or finishes up a tiny part of the story earlier on. Moore and Rhonda settled into voices for me. I've always tried to tell a story in first person, and I've never yet succeeded in staying with the one voice through the whole story because I always know more than that one person knows, and I'm not able to either be subtle enough in the way I deal with irony in one voice, or else I'm just too interested in showing all the other things too. So I let each person tell the story in first person, knowing that that would not be all, and I didn't feel cramped or having to think up ways to convey anything but what that person's opinions were. So Rhonda began. It was Rhonda's voice that I first heard, and I wrote down everything she had to say about him. And as she was saying it, Moore would respond. And then when Moore had his chance, I thought, well, I'll just tell his story. Maybe it's another story. And it was another story, and I told his story. And I know a great deal more about Moore than even Rhonda knows, but I think as the years pass, she'll probably find out. But then the boys had their turn, and also the father-in-law. And when I had all of those voices, I thought, now, how am I going to do this if I could just shuffle them in like cards? But what I did was I sat down, I said, I begin, and I let them interrupt each other. And I never explained where the voice comes from. I just assumed that it could be all in a counselor's office, or it could be, they could be not even in the same room, just talking to themselves. But each rejoinder in some way moves the story forward. And it all seemed to be one endless babble as this family just tells and tells and tells and tells. And I wanted it mostly to be their own voices telling it, although there is a bit of narration in between it. So I had fun thinking that one up. I enjoyed that.
What an interesting account of the creative process with regard to that story. Tell me, the characters in And Venus is Blue, they must have come out of your own past and knowledge. Tell me a little bit about that.
The characters?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any of my characters, I try for a vivid and lifelike and convincing and persuasive character on a page. I found that the way that I do that best is to find at least six people who have a similar emotional disaster or happiness or confrontation. And in general, I can find more than six of any such emotional type or problem. And so I just think over my whole life, and I imagine, in general, the Delia's character is would not be that hard to find that kind of heartbreak. And as I was growing up in school, I saw several school friends who had similar heartbreaks, although I did not know any, at that time I did not know any children of suicides. I only knew that in this story that would be the most awful thing to happen for her, would be the thing that no matter how terrible anything might have been, she could never have imagined that because of the guilt that would also leave. So I invented, rather than just saying it's a composite character, but it's also a composite plot. I didn't take from real life. I was a volunteer, like a VISTA worker, only for the state of Georgia, and I met many interesting people. And one of the interesting people I met gave me details for the attitudes of old Ms. and her daughter-in-law. But when I was a child, I stayed with a neighbor up the street while my mother and father and brother went off to work and school. And I was only there, I don't suppose it was even a year, but I could almost see our yard from that other yard. And it was as though I had been cast out, and all of life and the tide went the other way. And so I know that street that Delia lived on, because when I wrote about that, I was using my walking on that dirt road and the passion vines that I saw that looked like ballerinas. The blossoms looked like ballerinas. And I didn't know what it was called. We called it Maypop. And they were always bitter. And it was many, many years later until I found a ripe one. And we can take that any way you want to. But I learned a lot about Delia from things that have happened to me, but the events of her life are not my events. But the emotions are emotions that I know about. So I don't know how the characters come to be. I mean, I needed these people, and I knew a carpenter named Webb, and I intended to honor him, and I used his own name. I had not intended for James Racing, the character, to be a carpenter. I had intended him to be a lawman. And when I wrote a story in my first book, I used the lawman story in another way. And so I thought, well, I'll change. It doesn't matter. One of the things I try to do is show men at work and in jobs that most people don't honor in fiction. And so, or even in life, people don't notice the care and skill. One of my favorite poems is Hopkins' poem. I think it's Pied Beauty, where he says, all gear, and is it trade and tackle and trim? He's talking about fishing and how beautiful it is to catch a fish, but he's also talking about every trade there is in the world and how it has a beauty to the work and the knowledge and the skill. And so I generally find something that men do or women that is a skill that might be overlooked or not cherished, and I honored, in this case, carpentry. Many people who know about the building trade say I did a very good job, and I say, well, I have helped build, and I have also watched carpenters and contractors. We call them contractors, and we call it contractors and cement and insurance, but we have contractors instead of contractors where I live. So I've watched them work, and in our case, it was not always ideal, but I could see the ideal valor of those men and their skill, and I think it didn't hurt a bit to round off a little bit or sand a little bit. So that's where those characters came from. The name Racing is a tremendous mistake because I was riding not very far from my home on a back road, and I saw a sign, a Coca-Cola sign. So it says, drink Coca-Cola, drink Coca-Cola. In the middle it said, Racing Auto Parts. And I thought it was the family name, you see. Well, I live near Dixie Speedway, but it never occurred to me because it must have been 20 miles. And I thought, why would they have Racing Auto Parts? The only thing in stock cars I would think you would need would be the tires because everything else would be stock. You know, it wouldn't be racing parts. I didn't think. I didn't think at all, really. And so I said, Racing, and I wrote that down. It's a great name, a southern name that I had never seen. And it was years later that I found out that it was Racing, as in auto racing. But it kind of fit because they all went pretty fast.
Tell me about you. Where were you born?
I was born in Georgia.
Where?
Brunswick and Glenn County on the coast, between Savannah and Jacksonville.
And did you grow up there as well?
No, I've lived all over Georgia. And
how does one do that?
Move about. just move about. My elementary school years were in one small town, and then I moved for junior high school back to the coast, and then to the Carter country and the peanut and cotton country for high school, and then college was back in the Atlanta area.
Why did your family move around so much?
I'm not sure there would be a single good reason for that, but we all had a great dedication to education. And my mother's a teacher, and my father is a civil servant at that time. And the reason we moved, we were not going to move again. And all these moves occurred because he was working for the Navy at the Marine Base in Albany, Georgia. And that was an awfully long commute. It was too far. And so my mother said, well, if I can, I'll get a job teaching in that part of the county, or that part of the state, and we all moved again. I mean, when you're a child and your parents move, you go too if you're lucky. I mean, otherwise it would be a tragedy. You just left behind there.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
I grew up in a household that loves words and books. We don't have writers. I mean, it took me a long time to realize I was tending toward being a writer, or even I knew I wanted to write, but I thought that one could do that as one might do cooking or sewing or something, as something that one does without it being a full-time obligation or occupation. So I never realized I hadn't read much literary biography. I had read books. And I suppose I thought they just sprang into the world on Christmas Eve or for birthdays or something. I never really thought about the whole enterprise of publishing or anything. I didn't study in college. I studied science and wound up with a major in Spanish. It was sort of accidentally, because I wanted to graduate. And the science courses that would have finished my science degree were consecutive over three more quarters because we had a small staff, and I could take all the Spanish at once. So I did, and graduate in 3 years. So, I mean, my education is idiotic, I guess. I mean, you know, I'm not sure at all that I was prepared to be a writer. My household loved words. I learned to read by games. We had games at home, and I was reading books at four on my own. So I was an early reader, and I didn't learn the alphabet, you know, or anything like that. I just either knew words or I didn't know words, and we would unscramble them. That was how we learned a word a day. I can remember when I was three and four, we learned a word a day. It was given to us in the morning, and then we had to have it solved by evening. It wasn't scrambled up entirely. My brother's might be, but mine would be, no, this is the actual word, and it's an object in this house. You know, that sort of thing. And then I learned words as though one would learn trademarks. So my reading education has been interesting, and I think it's made a difference in how I read. I've never been quite settled in my reading habits.
Did you begin to write after college?
Oh, I wrote when I was a child. I wrote a book when I was eight.
A book? Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about that.
Oh, it was a Western. It was all the Westerns. They died heroically, vigorously.
With their boots on?
At twilight, and in each other's arms, and of childbirth and snakebite, and floods and drought, and Indian attack. But the Indians were noble, and I can't tell you all the ways. It was just everything I write about now, which is just the same kind of melange of heartbreak and endless disaster, one thing after another. And I realize now that I was doing the same thing then, only at that time I was using everything I knew from Hopalong Cassidy and Superman and all those silly things I was watching on TV. So as the years have passed, I found ways to find that kind of event and truth in the world. I can tell something that sounds more original, but I suppose I've got the same themes. So I don't really know why I'm a writer. I just believe that I was, when I would sit up in my crib, my mother said she would find me sitting just staring, and that the first word she ever heard me say that was independent and like a thought was gone. And it wasn't like something I wanted was gone. It was like a musing, gone. So apparently, just from way early, these things were on my mind, such as it was.
Tell me about your first published story.
My first published story was in, well, I was simultaneously published in September, the autumn of 78, a story in Yankee Magazine and a story in the Georgia Review.
Yankee Magazine, you?
Yes, and I've never written another story like it. It was a story about my mother's father's people, and I had been to, well, I had been here in the north for a family funeral, and I didn't know my father's people very well. When I went home, and we had something to do, I don't know, flowers or something to do at a family cemetery in Georgia, and then my mother said, well, I would like to see Uncle John's grave, and he was buried over in Forsyth County. That's been in the news lately, but not because of Uncle John, but she said, I want to go to Midway Church. And so we went across another county to Midway Church, and I just walked around, and I saw that it in the inside of this church, which looked like you were in an actual upturned boat. It was a beautiful church. I was deeply surprised. He had built this thing. It was like a wonderment for me to see this craft and beauty out in the middle of nowhere. And he had done this thing, this wonderful old farmer. And his name was there. And then I saw his name on a rock in the churchyard. And I was deeply, deeply moved to realize that if all these people hadn't been, I wouldn't have been. And I had never considered it or honored them in my life. And so I went home and I said, I was sitting thinking, you know, and I guess that's what you call it. And I saw the fence break. We had a barbed wire fence, and it was just a rambling rose was on it, and it was so heavy that summer, it broke. The brad holding the top wire arm broke and fell under the weight of roses. And the sentence came into my head, that was the summer the fence broke under the weight of roses. And I suppose because I had been to that cemetery and was thinking about two generations back, really, I wrote about those people. I don't know if I would have or how that all focused, but that was how that story began. And it was about Georgia. And when I thought, well, I think Yankee might. I'm familiar with the magazine. I was a subscriber, and I touched up Kennesaw Mountain and made it Mount Katahdin. And then I changed the cotton fields and peach trees to potato fields, and very little else that I changed. So Yankee accepted it, and I thought that sort of proved that I was really writing about people anywhere, although it was really the most specific thing I had written about family stories.
Now, the University of Georgia Press published your first collection, is that right?
Yes.
I have that correctly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you happen to be published by Tickner and Fields with your second book?
Well, how did I happen to be published by them? They offered to. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, how did this second book come about?
Well, I had not written it, and a Georgia writer who is published by Tickner and Fields sent an interview about me and my first book to what turned out to be my editor at Tickner and Fields. And she said, and I thought I didn't know anything about theme, listen to this. And it was an article about my comments that I had gone as late as, say, 1982, and didn't know that point of view was a technical term for, you know, how you set the story. Because I had received a manuscript, and this is wonderfully ironic, I suppose. It was from Houghton Mifflin, which is the Tickner and Field parent company. And I had sent it, and I had received it back, and the comment was, these are wonderful stories, but they're not a novel. You have difficulty with point of view. And I thought they meant that I was provincial. And I spent several years studying philosophy. I went back to the beginning of recorded history, and I read everything that I could. And I got as far as World War II, you know, and philosophers and about that time. And I heard at a writer's conference, the first I'd ever been to, and I heard that I kept hearing point of view, and I thought, well, it's a literary term. And I asked someone, and they said, well, yes. And then I thought over all that, and it was too stupid and hilarious. And I should never have told the story to the interviewer, and probably not to you either, but it was so funny. And that, and she said, if I didn't know what theme was, look here at this person. And the Katrina Kennison said, this is wonderful, you know. And she called me and said, are you writing anything now? And I said, no, I don't intend to. And if I do, it will be short stories. And she said, go ahead. So that was how.
She kind of nudged you, I guess, huh?
She strongly urged me to continue doing this. And I had sort of changed how I write. I'd taken a year off to think over how I was doing things and to be more conscious of my actual intentions as I began to write. And when I resumed, I had a list of things. I called a menu, and I said, well, I have many, many stories, and I was thinking of it. They're all being about domestic themes. I have about 25 stories on my menu, and I could send you the ones that could possibly go. I have titles, you know. And she said, all right. And so I began. And I wrote them, I guess, there were a couple I had finished just before that, but then I wrote them all in about a year. And it was all for the book. They weren't collected from other places. I intended to sort of make everything fit in the theme.
They do indeed fit very good. These are wonderful stories, and it only took me about two pages reading the story about Moore and Rhonda that I knew that I was going to like the book, and I wanted to talk to you. I'm delighted to have had the opportunity to discuss your work with you, and I'm certainly going to look forward to reading more of your material, because this is not going to be the last, is it?
I hope not. I really am working on something longer now, and I'm trying very hard to break myself of short stories for a while. So I am writing all about the same characters. And I had been writing this story for years, I mean years and years and years, and then here lately I've begun to think I'm approaching the final draft. So I'm thinking that within my lifetime.
Well, just don't move the characters into New England.
No, I won't touch up any more mountains.
Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's